right now, it's time for History Matters, taking a look back at this week in history with the one and only Scott Washington, history guru, who joins us now here in the studio. I got caught halfway through between saying history and historian and just ended up saying neither of them.
I described this time as kind of a jazz riff on history, so
Pretty much, it's kind of fun. Yeah, that was the improvisation that didn't quite work out all that well. We'll edit it in post. It's fine.
When I heard the music, I was immediately thinking of England and that giant blimp that was flying over London for a while.
Trump baby, you mean?
Yeah,
yeah, which is apparently coming to the U.S.
Did you hear about that?
Yeah, it's going on tour. Going to play Lollapalooza in a couple of weeks.
Well, this has been a good week for history. No balloons, but we do have somebody who's kind of significant in terms of the air, and that's, of course, Amelia Earhart.
Yes.
Has a birthday this week.
Yep. Tuesday.
July 24th, 1897. And quite, of course, you know, she was ahead of her time, and certainly she also supported the Equal Rights Amendment, too. Mm-hmm. Which was wonderful.
Way ahead of her time. It's fascinating the story of that, because we associate the fight over the ERA with the 70s, which is when it really picks up. But it doesn't start in the 70s. Like, it starts way, way, way back, a long time. Yeah.
Well, you can even go back to the temperance movement of the 19th century, when the effects of alcoholism were widely known but not understood. Mm-hmm. And it was women who were leading the fight for that. Of course, that led to prohibition, which was an extreme kind of reaction. Mm. And but again, women then got the vote.
And it's really fascinating. Like, the temperance movement was led by women. The suffrage movement, obviously, led by women. The anti-slavery movement earlier in the 19th century was led by women. And all of that was before they had the right to vote. These were people who could not vote, who had to... who had to get involved politically in other ways, and they did it by saying, okay, well, we'll just lead movements and make a difference that way. And they did in so many different ways.
Well, how much influence did Harriet Beecher Stowe's novel Uncle Tom's Cabin have in terms of the anti-slavery movement? I mean, profound. So
absolutely.
Yeah, this is a good time to remember.
How do we get from Amelia Earhart to...
We started with the balloon.
That took 45 seconds. But I mean, it all makes sense. It's like, we were talking about Amelia Earhart like a minute ago.
If they're listening, they're going, of course, what?
How do we do that? Yeah.
Well, of course, this week we look at, of course, all these monumental events that have happened in history. And there are some really great nuggets this week that made me really excited. One of these ones happens on July 25th, 1729. That's the date when North Carolina finally becomes a royal colony. Now you think, wait a minute, what was it before? Well, actually, it was kind of an entrepreneurial venture of the of different very wealthy folks in England, and who started this. And I think it was only the Earl of Granville refused to sell his shares back to the crown, and that creates a Granville district across the top portion of the state. But that's just a fascinating part of North Carolina's history to realize, or really of United States history, realize this was an entrepreneurial venture. It wasn't like, we're going to start a new country.
No,
it was like, this could be a profitable venture, and let's do it.
And then it was a profitable venture, and the stupid king comes along and decides to nationalize the industry.
That's right. Nanny gate the whole thing. And, you know, but that date, and this is, you know, it just happens like this. We've all heard of, and again, this is same July 25th, this time 1780. That's when an American general, Horatio Gates, took command of the Southern Army. And it all looked, you know, there was the British were turning their attention to the South. This looked like he was the fellow to lead it. And in fact, actually, it didn't work out quite that way, because we had British General Charles Cornwallis, who's in the South, who's a ferociously good commander and very ruthless and very disciplined with troops. They go to fight. I mean, here he is taking command July 25th, 1780. Great hopes. Yay. Finally, a general that will know what to do. And we have just less than a few weeks later, August 16th, there's a tremendous defeat. Now, the accounts are that there Gates' men were eating undercooked bread and getting diarrhea, and, you know, before the night, they were just not well prepared, didn't have bayonets. But what's fascinating about
this
all
this is the story
is
of war that you don't get from these, like, glorious depictions of battle.
And yet, that could be as debilitating as, you know, facing muskets.
It's more so, I think,
not having good food. And but his final action as commander was, you know, we've heard the midnight ride of Paul Revere. Mm-hmm. Okay, doesn't seem like much compared to this. He rides 240 miles north to report this total defeat in a letter to Congress sent from Hillsborough, North Carolina. Yeah.
Very cool.
And, of course, that leads to Nathanael Greene being appointed general, who's much more of a wily commander and actually is credited with helping rally and, if not outright defeat Cornwallis, at least cripple him enough that he's led up to.
So Gates's defeat and Greene replacing him, is that because of anything really that Gates did, or was it just his own bad luck to be serving at the same time as the bad bread was being served?
I think that's basically it.
Okay.
And the fact that he also probably rode 240 miles probably did not sit entirely well to say, you mean you left your troops, whatever remainder of them there, to ride to
that
run
probably,
and let us know.
Yeah.
That's the difference. And I like Nathanael Greene, who
you told
was,
me to call.
Yeah, Nathanael Greene was the fighting Quaker who replaces him, and his motto was a really great one: fight, get defeated, rise, fight again.
Yes.
And becomes a favorite of George Washington's. But when Cornwallis chases the remnants of these armies through North Carolina, expecting to smash them to smithereens, of course, it's a different story because Greene is in charge now. And he actually devises a diversionary force going up towards what is now Danville. Cornwallis chases the wrong army. The rest of Greene's army goes a little bit further east and north into Virginia. And when Cornwallis gets to the Dan River, which is as large as the Potomac, if anybody's ever been up there, he can't get across because the only ferry has ferried all the troops of Nathanael Greene's army across the Dan. And in the middle of February 1781, he's forced to retreat to the only metropolis in the area large enough for his army of 2,000 people, which happens to be Hillsborough.
Hillsborough again. Yeah, there you
has a feature in all this, which is kind of cool. The other thing that happens, which is more contemporary history, and it's, again, the same day, July 25th. I mean, these are really, really instrumental and important things, is the Greensboro lunch counters.
Yes.
On July 25th, 1960, open to the first time to all customers, regardless of race, due to the fact that there had been the sit-ins, of course, that began earlier, several months earlier in February of that year of 1960. And it just spread. It was so significant. Of course, now anyone can go to the International Civil Rights Center and Museum, located where the Woolworths was located, and actually have a wonderful tour there. So
yeah. And that's a fascinating story, and I think we've talked about this before, that the sit-in begins in February and immediately
in the middle of winter.
In the middle of winter,
which is also
right,
when the other things happen with the Hillsborough folks in that county.
Yeah.
So here
and
we are.
The people who are doing the sit-in are facing huge immediate resistance, not just from other people in Greensboro, but also from business owners, town leaders, state officials in general, and nothing happens, and they keep fighting, and they keep fighting, and they don't back down.
That's right.
And it's the not backing down that leads to, in this case, the integration a few months later in Greensboro,
right.
But that fight goes on in other cities, and it takes a long time, at least, I mean, not by social movement standards, but by, like, you wake up every single day and you haven't achieved anything, you don't feel like you've moved the dial, but you keep at it and you keep pounding and you refuse to back down, and sooner or later, in this case, the dial got moved.
And I think, and that's such a profound observation, because sometimes we think, oh, what difference does it make to protest injustice?
Mm-hmm.
But it does. It's these drops of water every single day of refusing to give in. That's what makes the difference. And that became a role model then for saying how everything else from that time, and that's why this is an international museum now, it became a real formidable kind of model for, if there is injustice, you continue to protest it. It doesn't matter if you get defeated. Just like Nathaniel Green, rise and fight again.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
So those are good things that come up those days.
All right.
What else?
Speaking with Scott Washington, talking about History Matters this week in history.
All right, I've got to say there's one other thing.
Reintroducing you to give you a second to look at the 40 pages that you've got in front of you.
Well, this one is kind of funny, but it's 1965, again on July 25th. This is when Bob Dylan, who's been playing acoustic guitar, plugs into the amp, and immediately, now this is fascinating because we don't even think about this, there is loud booing reported.
Yeah, this is at the Newport Folk Festival.
Yes, that people are just aghast, like, how can he do this?
Yeah.
And even Pete Seeger, you know, the great folk singer, said, if I had an axe, I'd cut the cable right now.
Look, it's their own fault for having an amp there. Who brought an amp to the Newport Folk Festival? Who allowed them to plug it in? Like, come on. You brought that on yourself, Newport.
Right. Well, decibels issues are really something in music to be considered. I remember going to hear Bob Dylan one time in concert in Winston-Salem, and it was at, I think, one of their old civic centers. Acoustics were terrible, and it was bouncy. It was hard to hear, except if you put both of your fingers in both of your ears, then the balance was perfect.
Oh, yeah. No, I do that at concerts all the time.
Yeah, it really does make a difference.
It really helps. The funny thing, then, is that, like, the Newport Folk Festival people, everyone in the audience hated it. All of the organizers hated it. The other performers all hated it. Dylan, of course, was exactly right to be doing what he did.
Yeah.
And then, a year or two later, Newport Folk Festival organizers start celebrating this as, like, a watershed moment in Newport Folk Festival history. Like, you don't get to do that. No.
I wonder if they repeated the booing that went on, too. Was this after people started destroying guitars on stage or something? Yeah.
So I remember back when I was growing up, they did on TV this retrospective of the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah.
And some of the things that they celebrated as being these, like, high mark watershed moments for the Ed Sullivan Show were, this one time when, like, he burst into the I think it was the Doors dressing room and said, you can't ever play the Ed Sullivan Show ever again. It's like, you don't celebrate that 30 years later. Like, stick to your guns. That was horrible. Like, Saturday Night Live doesn't bring Andrew Dice Clay back on, but they still celebrate that as, like, a watershed moment. Like, you go back to, like, the retrospectives of Saturday Night Live.
Right.
It's like, remember the time when Andrew Dice Clay was on, or Sinead O'Connor, or all of these other people? Like, no, you don't get to bring that back as, like, a proud moment in your history.
Well, we do get nostalgic and, and then you start looking at it a little bit, go, wait a minute, is this worthy, really worth celebrating? What are we celebrating? Oh, the Salem witch trials, those were the days. No, they weren't.
They do that, too.
They do that, too. Yeah. So those are, but there are some other things, and that's why we like to look at history, because it really does matter.
Yeah.
Here's a great one. On July 27th, 1976, an illegal immigrant who had been here living illegally and had an actual deportation order finally gets his green card. Now, can you believe this? It's just shocking. Now, you might know him better.
Especially considering what an agitator he was.
Yes, exactly.
Talk about subversive.
Gosh. I'm surprised that they didn't, they didn't have ICE then, because ICE wasn't developed until the last 15 years.
Yeah.
But this fellow did not go back, and he's actually became a U.S. citizen. You better know him better as John Lennon.
Dun, dun, dun.
Cars are screeching.
Yeah.
The other thing that happens, a couple other ones. I think this is kind of interesting one.
Wait, actually, go back a second. Why was there a deportation order on John Lennon? Why,
that's right.
Of all the many possible reasons there could have been.
1972.
We're
talking right around the time of both the Vietnam War and, of course, Richard Nixon was still there. So, the Beatles were fairly strong for anti-war. And I'm guessing that this may have been another issue, too.
Okay. But, all right.
Yeah. That's a good topic.
Because it could have also been marijuana. I mean,
that's true.
We were in the middle of that as well.
That's true.
Yeah. There were a lot of bad reasons that would have been used to
Brits, oh, I'll tell you, they're always.
Ever since they turned North Carolina into a royal colony back in 1725.
That's right. Sounds like a brand of something.
It all comes full circle.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, all right.
Well, here's
but I interrupted
one.
You. You had
another. Oh, no. Well, I was going to say this happens on the July 27th, and that's when, and it's here in North Carolina. A fellow named Thomas Clingman was born on this date in 1812 in what is now Yadkin County. And he serves as a U.S. senator, actually a Confederate general. But the most important thing he did was he boosted economic development in western North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the highest peak in the Great Smoky Mountain Range is named Clingman's Dome
in
his
honor.
Yeah,
they named the dome after him,
but
right?
The cool thing is that he actually, by promoting western North Carolina so well, he was strongly believed that which peak was the tallest. And Elisha Mitchell said the peak he thought was the one he claimed was the tallest. Mm-hmm. And Clingman, they went back and forth. Great feud. Well, of course, it developed a lot of publicity. People want to know. And finally, of course, when Mitchell's was actually 39 feet taller, of course, that becomes Mount Mitchell.
Mount Mitchell, yeah.
And we don't remember Clingman, but actually, he did so much to help promote that by engaging in this rivalry, a good-natured mm-hmm. rivalry, which is kind of fun. And also, the other thing, too, and a little somber note on July 27th, it's National Korean War Veterans Armistice Day, mm-hmm. in honor of the day when the armistice took place. Now, people think the Korean War, which began in 1953, that there was a peace treaty.
Ended in 53.
No, it didn't. It's actually like a truce.
Yeah.
An armistice takes place. But it's just shocking. How many people were affected by this. Now, the U.S. military deaths, about 34,000. But all in all, the total, now, I was really shocked to see this. About 5 million people mm-hmm. died in 3 years. That's just stunning and shocking. And
still paled in comparison to World War II, which we had just come out of.
Yeah.
So at that point, people, I think, were just so inured to being a devastating war.
That's right.
Yeah. We call that the Forgotten War, and I think that's why.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the closest we get to it is the MASH TV series with Alan Alda. And, you know, there are some elements we've watched that show, but mm-hmm. They kept it personal. They never kept this larger picture of what this was.
That's the other thing, too. And I think it's really fascinating to think about the way in which war gets depicted or not depicted in popular culture. Like, we have so many World War II movies. We have so many Vietnam movies. With Korean War, it really is just MASH. And let's be honest, that was a Vietnam movie, too.
Yes.
When it came out, people watched it in that context. And when the show was on the air, it was still very much in the context of Vietnam, even though it was set in Korea about the Korean War.
That's right.
People watched it through that other filter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't think we really realized the scope of this war.
No, absolutely not.
Anybody says, oh, yeah, that's a good thing. No, it's not a good thing.
What is the number two movie about Korea? I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I know there have been several, but like, what is there? And I don't know off the top of my head. I'll have to look that up. World War One also doesn't have as many.
No, that's right. And that was featured. That comes up in the news this week, too, because this is the week when World War One starts, because Archduke Franz Ferdinand is assassinated.
He's assassinated earlier. The declaration is this week,
That's right. Let's see. In fact, I think, ironically, on the 25th is when the fellow who assassinated him, Gavrilo Princip, was born on this date. And but he doesn't die in this war. He actually dies in prison from tuberculosis 20 years later. But that starts this whole gigantic war that takes millions of lives again, mm-hmm. the same sort of thing.
Speaking with Scott Washington, we got time for one more.
Okay.
What do you got?
Well, this is a good one. And for especially on a hot day, we need to thank Charles Minch of St. Louis, Missouri. In 1904, he's credited with inventing the ice cream cone.
Oh, thank goodness.
Now,
need those.
That's right. Now, I'm not sure about exactly how you invent, like, get my hammer out. I'm going to put I need another screwdriver here. Get this ice cream cone going. It's almost there.
God, this is terrible. Let's, we need to change the recipe.
That's right. Well, it's, and then some years early, about 75 years early, we had the first public swimming pool opens in Boston, Massachusetts in 1827.
Sounds
so
good.
Those are cool thoughts to keep us going on a hot day.
Yeah, sounds good. History matters. As always, Scott Washington, thank you so much.
Thank you, Aaron.